Hello and welcome to the Mariners Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. And in this episode, we're continuing the book, The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on the second book, 40,000 Miles Around the World. We're on chapter 18, and this is the 14th part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 18. Where is the Light? My first lecture. An amusing incident. And meeting with Maoris. Shortly after the demonstration had come to an end, the Tilikum was entrained again and taken down to Lyttelton. When afloat, Mr. Buckridge and myself went aboard and took our departure for Wellington, the capital of New Zealand, a distance of nearly 200 miles. With a moderate westerly breeze, we soon sailed the 4 miles down Lyttelton Bay, and once more the Tilikum poked her nose into the Pacific. The wind gradually hauled into the southeast, and with a fresh breeze, the boat went along flying towards Wellington. When we were nearly abreast of Cook Strait, the wind changed to the northeast and forced us in toward Cape Campbell, whose white revolving light we sighted shortly after dark. Just about that time, the wind returned to the original direction, and we shaped a course direct for Pencarrow Light, which stands at the eastern entrance of Port Nicholson. The southwesterly wind became very strong towards midnight. Pencarrow Light towers over 400 feet above the water and is visible at a distance of 30 miles. Therefore, to my reckoning, we should have sighted it at about midnight. So I began to look for it, for it is one of my established rules to be on the lookout when, according to dead reckoning, land or a light should come in sight and the vessel is shaping for it, and I never leave the deck until satisfied. But should the weather get thick and the likelihood of running into danger arise, I do what every careful navigator should do in unfamiliar surroundings, viz. Put the vessel's head offshore and wait till the weather clears. On this occasion, with the exception of a few clouds hanging about here and there, the weather was quite clear. Being sure that we were in sighting distance of the light but still unable to see it, I went to the forward end of the boat where the sails did not obstruct the view. My mate was steering and the Tilikum went along with the wind and a large sea right after at 7 miles an hour. I stood there from 1 till 5 o'clock when I thought that we should be within 5 miles of the light, but still I could not make it out. The morning hours were very dark and I considered the advisability of heaving to wait for daylight, when suddenly the light appeared right ahead of us and up in the sky. Apparently the light in question stands too high to be seen in cloudy weather, as, owing to its lofty situation, dark clouds at times will accumulate and obscure it from view. Regarding lights that are visible for upwards of 25 miles, I may say that I have never recorded another incident of the kind. The night being dark and both of us unacquainted with the locality, we hove to under small sail. When day broke, we kept the boat before the wind and, with a strong southerly breeze, sailed into Wellington Harbour, dropping anchor near Queen Street Wharf. Wellington is the capital of the Dominion of New Zealand, and its inhabitants very much resemble their fellow countrymen in the other places where I had called. All had ample means of living, and seemed contented and happy, and as I was still hustling for the millions which I had failed to secure on Cocos Island, I took the Tilikum ashore and had her exhibited in a large hall. It was for the first time in my life that I mounted a stage to address an audience, a task which, so far, had been out of my line. I shall never forget the moment when I stepped onto the stage and saw nearly 600 people looking at me and watching every movement I made. Fortunately, the stage was strongly constructed, otherwise I think I should have fallen through it. A few days before the lecture was to take place, an experienced speaker who instructed me in the art of lecturing warned me of stage fright. "When you mount the stage," he said, "and see the audience in front of you, you might become nervous and won't be able to speak, as is frequently the case with beginners. If that should happen, just imagine that all the heads you see before you are nothing but a field of cabbages, and soon you will be all right." Now, to allow my imagination to run away with me in this manner was, for a man like me, who had met so many New Zealanders and had learned to like them, a little more than I thought I should be capable of. but as my instructor assured me it was part of the business, it had to be so. So I spoke for about an hour, after which my mate, Mr. Buckridge, took the floor and delivered a very interesting lecture on his experiences whilst with Captain Scott's South Pole expedition in the Discovery. Among other occurrences, he related the jolly time they had when the vessel was frozen in during the dark and cold winter months, and how he and his comrades used to commandeer some excellent old scotch from the officer's stateroom and hide it in the snow where it would freeze, and instead of drinking whiskey in the ordinary way, they would eat it as they would ice cream. When Mr. Buckridge had nearly finished his story, his voice suddenly dropped, his eyes widened, and he looked very much bewildered. At first I thought he suffered from a sudden attack of heart failure, but he managed to finish his speech in a whisper, which I'm quite sure nobody could hear, and then gave a little bow as if to say, "That will be all you're getting from me tonight, my good people," and thereupon received a deafening ovation from the audience. The latter then left their seats and crowded round the tillicum, and I was just about to ask my mate whether he felt ill, when a tall, handsome young gentleman stepped up to the stage and, shaking hands with Buckridge, said, with a smile, "I could never understand what became of my whiskey." He was no other than Lieutenant Ernest Shackleton of the Discovery, and Mr. Buckridge happened to recognise his face amongst the audience immediately after telling of the iced whisky he had enjoyed so much in the frozen plains of the South. Lieutenant Shackleton is now Sir Ernest, and judging from what I saw of him in Wellington and later on in Scotland, and what I have read and heard about him since, all the harm I wish him is that he may become an Admiral of the British Fleet before reaching his 40th year. A splendid critique in the next morning's newspapers served as an instigation to us to speak on several succeeding occasions to full houses, and at the request of a white Maori chief from Palmerston North, a fair inland city, we put the boat on a train and in company of the chief journeyed overland to that place. In the country surrounding Palmerston live many Maori farmers who came to town by the hundred to give us a call. They were more than pleased to see a canoe which had crossed the ocean to their country, and the fact apparently strengthened their belief that in days of yore their ancestors had emigrated in large canoes to New Zealand from some distant region of the Pacific. One Maori who spoke English fluently told me that he had never credited the legend, as he thought it impossible to cross the ocean in such a frail craft. And now, as I see with my own eyes that you have covered thousands of miles in this Indian canoe and have arrived safely on our shores, I no longer question that my forefathers can have accomplished the same. Chapter 19. Whanganui, ladies on board, and a wet afternoon. Having spent a few days at Palmerston North, we again boarded the train, and making short stops at Fielding and other country towns, proceeded down to Whanganui, which is a port of considerable size situated about 4 miles from the mouth of the Whanganui River, one of the most beautiful streams in the world. Across the mouth of the river lies a bar over which the sea breaks very heavily at times, and as some Whanganui people had read of our feat at Sumno, we were requested to repeat the performance. Consequently, arrangements were made to give a demonstration, this time in the Tillicum herself and under sail. While staying at Whanganui, we had taken up quarters at a hotel which was owned by a young couple who, like almost all New Zealanders, were fond of sport. They asked me to be good enough to give them a trip on the Tillicum, and I replied that on the day fixed for the demonstration, they were welcome to sail with us as far as the river mouth. "Oh, thank you," the lady exclaimed. "That will be so nice." I will try to describe to my readers how nice it turned out to be. When the appointed day came, the landlord was unable to leave his house for stress of business, so his place was taken by a lady friend who joyfully agreed to accompany his wife, and in the pleasant company of both ladies, we sailed down the Whanganui. When we arrived at the river mouth, the wind had died out, and in consequence, the prospects for our performance became poor. It was about 2 o'clock when large and heavy seas, which almost broke on the bar, came running in towards us. Many people had arrived from Whanganui by train to watch the Tillicum crossing the bar, but there being not the slightest breeze, the boat could not be sailed, and therefore those standing along the beach wore a disappointed look. "Something must be done to create a little excitement," I said to my mate, "but how?" As luck would have it, just then a launch about 30 feet in length arrived from Whanganui with a dozen passengers on board, and as the bar was not breaking then, the captain volunteered to tow us across. When everything was ready for the start, I advised our two lady passengers to go ashore. "No, please, Captain," our landlady entreated, "don't put us off now, when the real fun is to commence." "My good ladies," I endeavoured to persuade, "there will be not much fun if one of those high seas should happen to break on us when going out." "We won't mind that a bit," the other assured me. "And getting soaked with salt water, what about that?" I queried. "Oh, that we would enjoy enormously," they both asserted. Feeling confident that nothing serious could happen, I made no further objection and told the captain of the launch to go ahead. In a few minutes, we were amongst the big, rolling seas. Crossing the bar at a rate of 6 miles an hour, both boats rose comfortably to the seas as they came along until we got about halfway across the bar, when an extra-large sea broke between the launch and our boat. I knew at once what was going to happen, but it happened so quickly that the breaker was upon us ere we had time to hurry the ladies into the cabin. Before the breaker came over all four of us, we were sitting in the cockpit, and when the Tillicum dived into it, our landlady clung to some ropes and cleats, whilst her companion, who was one of the belles of Whanganui, grabbed my mate round the neck and hung on for grim death. Even when all was over, he could hardly induce her to let go again. Why, our charming passenger should have cuddled my mate around the neck and squeezed him in the way she did, instead of me, I was at a loss to understand, for at the time when the breaker came down on us, I was certainly much nearer. However, we succeeded in getting across the bar without further trouble. This was the only sea that broke upon us in going out, but, nevertheless, it was sufficient to give all a good soaking. In returning, we had a similar experience, but on this occasion we managed to shelter the two ladies in the cabin, shutting the door on them. When we were about the middle of the bar, a large sea, as before, broke under the stern of the Tillicum. She took a little water over, but went along with the breaker at a tremendous speed, with the result that, in a few minutes, we were almost alongside the launch. Presently, the breaking sea passed under us and embraced the launch. As we had 150 feet of towline out, a bight was formed alongside our boat, and the latter naturally stopped headway while the launch forged ahead with the breaker at a terrific speed. When the towline became taut, it parted, causing the launch to broach to. Instantaneously, the sea broke over her weather rail and almost resulted in her, with all on board, going to the bottom. As it was, the water she shipped stopped her engine, but luckily enough, no more breaking seas came in, and she was bailed out and got safely into the river. The Tillicum, with her two lady passengers, who were now in a sorry plight, followed suit. The breakers at Whanganui were then not nearly as high or so dangerous as were those we had experienced at the Sumno Bar when crossing it six times in an open 18-foot boat, and the accident on this occasion could have been easily avoided if the launch had been allowed to go slow in crossing the bar, as I had advised the captain. Instead, she was driven full speed ahead, and consequently the accident happened, as it will 9 times out of 10 when care is not taken, and possibly with more disastrous results. I told the captain afterwards that it was not his seamanship, but the hand of Providence which had saved his vessel and the lives of those on board. Chapter 20. A Gale in the Cook Strait and an Uncomfortable Night. New Plymouth. 3 days later, we left Whanganui for New Plymouth, on the east coast, distant about 100 miles. Cook Strait truly resembles its great namesake. Like Captain Cook, it is not to be trifled with. When it blows there, it blows hard, and owing to shallows and currents, a very bad sea is experienced. Sailing from Whanganui with a moderate easterly breeze, accompanied by a hazy sky, we directed our course to the southwest. This served our purpose by enabling us to obtain sea room to meet a possible gale. We were no more than about 20 miles off the land when the wind hauled into the southwest with fast increasing force. However, in order to clear the lee shore still further, we held our course until the wind and seas compelled us to take in the sails and heave to under sea anchor. To be only 20 miles off a lee shore in a heavy gale is rather risky, and we had gained little more. So to lessen the drift of our boat, we rigged a second sea anchor. For this purpose, we employed our bunk boards, some old canvas and ropes, and one of our ordinary anchors. We discovered that with the two sea anchors, the drift of our boat did not exceed 3/4 of a mile, and we therefore felt assured that the gale would have to blow quite a long time before the Tillicum would strike the rocks. Having a riding sail over the stern besides, and after putting a light on deck, we both sat down in the cabin, and over a comfortable smoke, talked about our experiences on the Whanganui Bar a few days previously. Meantime, the gale raged, and it proved to be the worst I experienced throughout my cruise in the Tilikum. It was accompanied by large, hollow-breaking seas, and our little vessel had to do all she could and tried strenuously to rise to the top of some of the high combers. She rolled and pitched, with heavy spray flying over her, sluggishly working her way over the seas. It was the first gale my mate experienced in the Tilikum, and he complained of the continuous rolling and pitching, saying that it made him sick. Before many hours had passed, we were wishing for a change in the weather, but the wind did not moderate, and was later accompanied by heavy rain squalls. The night was so dark that we could not see a hand before our eyes. As we drifted more and more landward, I commenced to feel a little uneasy, for I knew that if the gale lasted all day, we would be smashed to pieces before nightfall. But a good shipmaster never reflects on danger until he be right near it. I stuck to the principle and refrained from expressing my thoughts about the weather and the lee shore to my companion, but waited patiently for the change, which eventually came with unexpected suddenness. It was before daybreak when the wind rapidly hauled into the southeast and the seas soon lost their dangerous breaking caps, when I steered the Tilikum to the westward. At 7 o'clock, the weather cleared up, and our approximate position then being 10 miles off the land and 40 miles from Cape Egmont. As a reminder of the previous night's gale, a large swell was still settling through the southwest, but otherwise the wind and weather were all that one could wish, and helped my mate's stomach to recover its equilibrium. Early in the afternoon, we rounded Cape Egmont and shaped our course for New Plymouth, which then was not more than 25 miles distant. However, the wind lightening during the night, we failed to reach port before the following morning. New Plymouth is a nice little town of about 5,000 inhabitants, and owing to the splendid farming country surrounding it, is named by the Maoris Taranaki, i.e. the Garden of New Zealand. Mount Egmont, which rises approximately to a height of 8,600 feet above sea level, is clearly seen in fine weather, being only about 15 miles distant from New Plymouth as the crow flies. It forms a most beautiful feature of the landscape, with its regular cone crowned with a white cap of snow. One great drawback of the city appears to be the fact that there is no harbour. The Garden of New Zealand is mostly populated with Maoris, and when they discovered that we had come a long way in a canoe, they apparently felt like their countrymen at Palmerston, reminded of the glorious days of the past, and honoured us with a welcome in Maori style. In crowds, they flocked to town from the neighbouring districts to inspect our little vessel, and a song was given us in native language, followed by quite a long speech delivered by a chief. The natives then inspected the Tilikum inside and out, and having satisfied themselves that she was a real canoe, gave us 3 cheers before they departed. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.